Do we say, do we speak the words of truth and justice, or do we use and speak the speech of oppression and tyranny? Do we use our tongues to speak the truth, or do we use our tongues to speak lies and cheat and deceive and corrupt? This small piece of flesh, but so powerful that it can change hearts, it can guide hearts towards light and truth, but it can also misguide hearts towards darkness and evil. Beautiful wisdom brought to us by this dialogue from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Imam al-Baqir had a wasiyya, a will. Part of his will was to Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayh, that for 10 years in Mina, the 7th of Dhul Hijjah is when believers start gathering for Hajj. The recommendation is before Yawm al-Arafah, which is the 9th, and Yawm al-Tarwiyah, which is the 8th, for the believers to gather in Mina. The Imam passed a day before that, or was martyred, rather, a day before that. For 10 years, he said to his son, for him to commemorate the demise, the shahada of Imam al-Baqir in Mina, so that the believers, the Muslimun, those who knew of the Imamah of the Ahlul Bayt, those who were oblivious to that, to all hear about the demise and really the Shahada of Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayh, which is itself this particular will, this wasiyya of Imam al-Baqir, shows that he was trying to get a message across, similar to Imam al-Husayn, that after his Shahada, the commemoration of Imam al-Husayn was something that was upheld by the Ahlul Bayt ever since. Imam al-Baqir wanted the commemoration of his demise where all Muslimin can see and hear about it, because there was something about it, and that is that the authorities caused his death. And so it's a death of shahada, martyrdom, as we have in other ahadith. Although unfortunately, as we've said before, the details of that martyrdom have not been shared with us. We don't have much explanation as to how it occurred, but clearly the various ahadith, including this will of Imam al-Baqir, tell us that the Imam did not pass away a natural death.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining the meaning of justice. So the question we want to address today is this: what exactly do we mean by justice? In the discussion on the justice of God, it's necessary to first of all clarify the meaning of this term before we begin the examination of the reasons why God is just, as well as answering the objections that have been leveled against the justice of God. The topic of the justice of God is one of those topics that has been is debated not only amongst scholars, but also by common people as well. So this is one of those topics, one of those hot topics that a lot of people have a lot of questions about, and it deserves to be addressed and discussed. Of course, we do give the reservation that in the context and in the parameters of our broadcast, we can't exactly examine these in a total and a complete way, but we do want to give indications that can help our listeners maybe clarify some of the obscurities and ambiguities regarding this topic. So the question we want to address is the meaning, what the meaning of justice is in this discussion. As we said in some of our previous sessions, justice means basically to place something in the place that's proper to it and that it's suitable to it. As you can see, in this sense, justice is one of the attributes of the actions of a person who is just. Meaning the just, we say that his action is just, meaning this action has been performed in a way that's suitable to it, in a place that's suitable to it, in a time that's suitable to it. Now, the suitability of an action, in other words, how do we know that a certain place or a certain time is suitable to a certain action? And this is something that varies from case to case. It's possible that reason and the intellect may understand whether a certain time or a certain place or a certain situation and in a certain context is suitable to a certain action. For example, reason says that it's improper to punish somebody without first having explained him his responsibility. Punishing somebody in the place or in the time before one has explained to him his responsibility is considered wrong and unjust. This is not the suitable time to punish somebody. Yes, after one has explained him what his responsibility is, one, and secondly, he hasn't performed it. In this situation, reason says that punishing the person is suitable and proper, is just, in other words. So this is a place where reason understands, right, the suitability of this place and understands what justice is. But in certain situations, reason is incapable of doing so. It falls outside of the boundaries of reason. Like, for example, reason understands that it's necessary for God to give the people a law, right? To give the people a law that can preserve them from society and preserve them and the people who live in society from falling into chaos, killing one another and destroying one another. A law is necessary to preserve them from these calamities and these maladies. Reason tells us that it's improper for God to leave the people without a law. But what exactly the details of that law is, this is something that reason doesn't understand. The details and the particulars of that law is something that it is incapable of independently understanding. This is a place where it needs revelation. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were examining the meaning of justice and its different categories. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key.
on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the most important social teachings in Islam, rather it's not a teaching that Islam brought, it was something that was already there, but Islam molded it, shaped it, and made it of great importance because it is the foundations of society. And that is obviously the concept of marriage. We all know the very famous tradition of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who says that, you know, marriage is from my sunnah, from my tradition, and whoever turns away from it is not from my ummah or is not from me. The tradition has been mentioned like this. So we see that marriage is something that is extremely emphasized and, you know, pushed in Islam. But it is not something that is easy. You know, it is something that you requires work on. It is something that requires a person to kind of go in with a certain amount of expectations, or rather a certain amount of no expectations. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear youth today, especially our dear young brothers and sisters, is a book that tries and helps them on this path of both in their youth, while being married, and afterwards. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be introducing this book, which personally I benefited from, and hopefully all our dear listeners may also find it useful in their future endeavors, especially in the concept of marriage. Inshallah, until our next segment, see you then.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. In our last segment, we discussed the topic of marriage, and we said that, you know, a youth going into this particular divine, you know, relationship between a man and a woman and the foundation of society has to go in with a certain amount of know, a certain amount of knowledge, and so on and so forth. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that has been translated with the title For a Better Future. The book was written by Abdul Azim Al-Muhtadi Al-Bahrani. So it's very possible that the original book was in Arabic, and it was translated by Abdullah Al-Shaheen and published by Ansarian Publications in the holy city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this book contains 200 questions that were asked of the particular scholar. So these questions were either asked to him, however they were asked him, by youth of that particular place that he was in, via email, via phone. I don't even existed at that time. But these are questions that were posed to him, more likely letter form. And obviously the answers that he wrote back were then compiled into this collection of, assisting the youth in three specific ways. Why do I say three specific ways? Because the book thereafter is structured into three sections. The first section deals with what the youth need, and therefore it is just a basic introduction of questions that youth about their own personal experiences, their own personal life, and so on and so forth, have asked the author. The second section, or part two, is titled Husbands and Wives, Sharing Lives and Seeking Happiness. So obviously this is now about marriage, what to expect in marriage, what to do in marriage, you know, the expectation they want you to have from their spouse, and so on and so forth. And the last section deals with one of the most important aspects of marriage, and that is what? Procreation. Part three is titled Children Are Tomorrow's Adults. The book then ends with two supplications from the Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, the supplication for one's parents and the supplication for one's children. So this is the overall view of the book. And inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading one of the questions that was posed to the author together with the relevant answer that was given to that particular question. So inshallah, my dear listeners, we hope to see you then.
7 barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only King.
Stay tuned to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. You are listening to our program Bookshelf, where we are discussing a book that has been titled For a Better Future, which deals with marriage, youth, and child upbringing, which is a compilation of 200 questions and answers. One of the questions that was posed to the author, which in the book is the third question, it's a very important question, and it's something that we all can benefit from. So the question was this. So again, this is probably from a youngster asking the Sheikh. The Sheikh being who? Abdul Azim Al-Muhdari Al-Bahrani. So the third question is this. How do I ask forgiveness for my sins? So that is the title of the question. So the question is this. I am a young man. I have been involved in a great sin. Feeling sin on the one hand and my weak determination before my lust on the other hand have made me desperate of the forgiveness of Allah, and I feel that I will definitely be in hell. At the same time, I fear that I am not right in this opinion. Would you please guide me to the right solution? Again, this is a verbatim reading from the book. As you can see, there are certain issues with the translation. The answer. Confess your sin before Allah and pray to Him to help you with a real repentance. You do not need to ask for forgiveness with a difficult language or eloquent words. Speak easily and spontaneously and say what is inside your heart in any way you can. For Allah knows what is in one's heart even before it comes to his tongue. Know well that the sparing of the forgiveness of Allah is a sin even greater than the sin you were originally involved in, because despair opens the door wider before you to commit all sins. And it is this that will get you into hell and not your first sin. Therefore, Islam has considered despairing of Allah's mercy as the greatest of sins. It is this that Satan, the first enemy of man, wants for you on the day of resurrection. O young man, fill your heart with a big hope of getting the forgiveness of Allah and try determinedly not to commit the sin again. So inshallah, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly seek forgiveness. Inshallah, until our next program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Thank you.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
It was the demise, the anniversary of the demise of our great leader, the one who revived Islam in human society after a period of darkness, total darkness, where the entire globe was being ruled by kufr.
Imam Khomeini is a mujaddid, not the mujaddid of Islam. Islam cannot be. Islam is the pure Islam of Allah and the Quran and the Prophet and the Imams and Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayhim ajma'in. That does not. Islam in society requires tajdeed. So the same way the house of God, the Kaaba, that place is the house of God, but the building was ruined. It needed reconstruction for man. Otherwise, the house of God, the Kaaba, al-Baytul Atiq, the angels were doing tawaf around the Kaaba, Baytul Atiq, in the spiritual realm. But for man, that's all there. But for man, that building, that structure, for man's worship of Allah, for man's guidance, it needed reconstruction. Islam required reconstruction in the Ummah of the Prophet. The bricks had fallen off, they were scattered. The connections were lost. The connections between verses were lost. The connection between the words of the Ahlul Bayt and the verses were lost. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with this man, Imam Khomeini, that took us back to the teachings of Islam. And we have only seen a glimpse of light of what Islam does. And we see these liberated souls and hearts. How people that would otherwise be selfish, be involved in their personal lives, are going and putting their lives on the line to supply believers of other ethnicities, other racial backgrounds with support to be able to defend themselves, financial support, military support, advice, even blood
believers from Iraq, from the Islamic Republic, from Syria, defending each other, ethnicities that are not there, even religions that are not theirs, all the dhimmis that we have in Iraq mostly and in Syria, these people that are under, we as Muslims are obligated to establish a government protecting them. These believers went out of their way, putting their lives on the line, sacrificing their lives to protect these people who don't even share the same faith. This is beauty. This is beautiful, wonderful. Instead of putting your knee on the neck of a person just because he's from a different racial background, because the way you've been taught in this corrupt, ugly, filthy society that's governed by ideology of kufr, rejecting divinity, rejecting God, rejecting purity, rejecting rahmah, rejecting mercy. Individuals are victims to it. This person is not, it's not a solitary case. It's not one person. It's not about this individual. It's an ideology that causes people to behave this way. When you see a black person, if you're not from that background, you are told to feel badness, to feel you don't want to be around that person, to feel you don't want to be in that neighborhood. That's the teaching of the tyranny. The Fir'aun system is that. إِنَّ فِرْعَوْنَ عَلَى فِي الْأَرْضِ جَعَلَ أَهْلَهَا شِيَعًا. This is the way of the Fir'aun. Divide people up. يَسْتَضْعِفُ طَائِفَةً مِنْهُمْ. Select a group based on whatever ethnic background, racial background, religious background, something, and oppress them. يَسْتَضْعِفُ طَائِفَةً مِنْهُمْ. That's the way of the Fir'aun. That's how a Fir'auni system works. This is a Fir'aun system. It encourages and it influences for someone with a Hispanic background to not feel comfortable around someone from an African-American background or from an African background. Someone with an African background not to feel comfortable with someone that is not from that background. From someone that comes from a white background not to feel comfortable. That's how people are taught. This is the system of the Fir'aun. Dividing people up. Preferring one over the other. One feeling privileged. One having access to privileges, others not having that access. That's the system of the Fir'aun. That's not the individuals in it. That's the system of the Fir'aun. And if the individuals follow that, they're poisoned by it. And of course, whoever follows it and accepts it is going with it to hell. Whoever accepts the tyranny of the Fir'aun is going with the Fir'aun to hell. Whoever accepts Trump and the Trump system, and it doesn't matter, it's not about Trump. Obama was the same fool. It's the system. Under Obama, the same number of people were incarcerated from his racial background. Doesn't matter, it's the system of the Fir'aun. It's not this person or the other person. And it's not only in this part of the world. This Fir'aun has a claim to be the leader of the world. They established the United Nations. They give them these nice names to cover the filth of what they're actually doing. It's a means to govern the world, to bring people to their knees. Negotiations. These are the military and negotiations are two sides of the same sword carried by the same tyranny and tyrannical regime, oppressing the different peoples of the world. The different peoples of the world. It's not only here. It's not only here. For us to only be upset or be more upset when it happens to someone that's closer to us is moving away from the teachings of Amir al-Mu'mineen. It's moving away from the teachings of Islam. It's moving away from humanity. Moving away from humanity. What does this mean that I love my people? The people of the world are my people. Why do I differentiate? When I differentiate, that means I have accepted the tyranny of the Fir'aun. I have accepted the system of the Fir'aun. The people of the world are my people. Color of skin, language, culture is not something to differentiate between us. We are all the children of Adam. Ya Bani Adam. The Quran says, for me to feel worse when someone from this racial background, the other, yes, it's understandable if someone I have spent time with, those are natural things that develop when someone that is your child or things like that, but then someone who I don't have a connection with, the connection is the color of skin. That's not what Islam says. That's not what humanity is. Humanity is all humanity. If I differentiate, I have also accepted racism.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
We get people.
Taxpayer money for Israel.
The U.S. keeps providing billions of taxpayer dollars in foreign military aid to Israel. Almost all U.S. aid to Israel is now in the form of military assistance, know-how, and bombs meant to target resistance from Palestine to Lebanon and beyond. But some evidence shows that the once sacred cow of U.S. funding for Israel is being questioned today in places like Congress. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi. With Israel inflicting a death count on the Palestinians, one question is, who is to blame? And whoever the other culprits may be, U.S. comes out on top.
And end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees, and emboldens the apartheid policies that Human Rights Watch has detailed thoroughly in their recent report.
Calls for an end to U.S. aid has been on top of the agenda for many pro-Palestinian activists inside the United States. That has been boosted since Israel announced the ceasefire after being met with heavy resistance from the Gaza Strip and the rest of the occupied lands. Retaliatory attacks by the Hamas resistance movement was in response to Tel Aviv's aggression.
In 1967,
the latest round of tensions kicked off over the Zionist regime's expansive policies, in part involving eviction of Palestinians from the good city's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. With Israel's brutality laying bare again, human rights activists got engaged in raising awareness about U.S. support for Israel. Our first guest is Dr. Ahlam Mohtaseb, professor at Media Studies at California State University, San Bernardino. She's also the director of the Center for the Study of Muslim and Arab Worlds. Dr. Mohtaseb, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for accepting our invitation. How do you think the U.S. aid to Israel is justified as necessary for the American people, despite atrocities by Israel against Palestinians?
It's actually not justified. The problem is that most Americans don't know about that. They are in the dark when it comes to how their tax money is being used to support an oppressive racist regime like the Israeli one. So a lot of times when I have talks or panels, you know, around the country, like on Friday, I had a panel with Antioch University. When I mentioned the $3.8 billion of annual military aid to Israel, people in the audience were shocked. They were absolutely shocked. And one of them said, I want to investigate how I could withhold my tax money from being paid for oppressing another people.
Tel Aviv has once again failed in its war, and Palestinian resistance emerged victor. But military offensives by Israel is just one aspect of the Zionist regime's aggression against Palestinians. Israel's military aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip has been one go to action by the regime to pretend it is defending against what it calls terrorism by resistance groups like Hamas.
Terrorists launch rockets at civilians, launch rockets from schools and hospitals, putting kids at risk. They use humans as shields. Hamas is a terrorist organization sworn to wiping out the only Jewish state on earth. And the House of Representatives previously declared it shall be the policy of the United States to officially and publicly condemn Hamas for violating the international law of armed conflict by exploiting civilians.
The so-called Israel right to self-defense has been the marketing strategy to pile up money among Israel lovers, including in the United States. In America, U.S. taxpayer money is sent to the Zionist regime to defend itself. After all, Israel has occupied a vast portion of the Muslim land, therefore could expect to have enemies in the region. Our next guest is Max Blumenthal, American journalist, author, blogger, and filmmaker. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Many thanks for accepting our invitation. Mr. Blumenthal, the Israeli advanced military equipments, such as the Iron Dome, have at times failed against Palestinians' rockets. What does that mean in part for the U.S.-Israel military cooperation?
Well, I think one of the things that has been exposed here is the weaknesses of the Israeli military that has been constructed with American know-how, American weapons platforms, and based on a very American style of fighting. The Israeli F-15 exists primarily to attack families and civilians in the Gaza Strip. It was unable to suppress rocket fire. Israeli drones, Israel sort of pioneered the drones. They were ineffective as well.
The Gazans' resistance against Israel's iron hand later spread across all the occupied territories, where the Muslim population is fed up with Tel Aviv's crackdown and land grab. Tel Aviv's policies are funded by the United States and the pro-Israel Jewish lobby in the country. AIPAC is a favorite place for those seeking power in the U.S.
And I'm proud to say and be that among the many voices represented here, the California delegation is the largest and hopefully the loudest. There you go. So, having grown up in the Bay Area, I fondly remember those Jewish National Fund boxes that we would use to collect donations to plant trees for Israel. Years later, when I visited Israel for the first time, I saw the fruits of that effort and the Israeli ingenuity that has truly made a desert bloom.
The U.S. money is spent on a various range of sectors, including the military and the intelligence, in order to take on Palestinian youths and families refusing to bow to Israel's expansive policies. In the latest aggression, the Israeli military came under fire globally over its crimes against Palestinians, especially those residing in Gaza, which has already been under crippling Israeli siege. But has Israel achieved anything?
Well, what we saw with this assault was Israel's failure to achieve any victories or goals or objectives of military significance. The Israeli army failed to kill any high-level Hamas commanders. It's always targeting Mohammed Deif, the chief of staff of the Al-Qassam brigades, and they can never get him. They failed to suppress rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. They failed to even prevent the factions in the Gaza Strip from hitting Israeli vehicles and tanks outside the frontiers of Gaza. And so instead, what they did was slaughter entire families, kill civilians as a means of attempting to deter Gaza from attacking. And it actually, all this does is create more unity among Palestinians, but it also highlights to Americans how Israel's right to defend itself is actually a right to exist outside of any international legal conventions, any human rights law, and to kill civilians as it wishes as a means to maintain its ethnically exclusive apartheid system, where these refugees in the Gaza Strip, 80% of the population are refugees, have to be maintained in a human warehouse as surplus humanity because they are not allowed to be part of a country that unfortunately brands itself as a Jewish state.
In retaliation for the Israeli regime's aggression, the skies over Israeli cities were lit up by thousands of rockets fired by Hamas and other Palestinian groups. The Israeli Iron Dome, for which a ton of money has been spent, has failed to protect Israel from Palestinian rage.
The Prime Minister also shared with me his appreciation for the Iron Dome system, which our nations developed together and which has saved lives of countless Israeli citizens, both Arab and Jew. I assured him of my full support to replenish Israel's Iron Dome system to ensure its defenses and security in the future. Over the last 11 days, I spoke with the Prime Minister 6 times.
For decades, billions of dollars in American military aid to Israel has been justified as necessary for the regime to crack down on Palestinians who want their occupied lands back. Many pro-Palestinian activists believe that the U.S. leaders must acknowledge it is the time to end polishing the armor of the regional bully. So what efforts are underway to raise awareness about the U.S. military aid to Israel and how it is spent against the Palestinians?
A lot of activist organizations and groups in the United States have been very, very active in educating Americans about those issues. So there are a lot of petitions being signed, especially from American Muslims for Palestine, Al-Auda, and similar organizations who have been actually pushing people to spread awareness through social media, mainly because this is our, the outlets that we can have access to in the United States. But also I have to admit that things are changing to a great extent, although the change is kind of slow, but it's very steady and it's happening. So look at the 12 Congress persons or congressmen and women who actually pushed Biden to take a more firm position against Israel and to actively get involved in having a ceasefire. And those are more on the side of what we call progressive Democrats.
The military tango between Israel and the U.S. means the regime must buy American equipment, and in exchange, Washington guarantees not to sell weapons to other West Asian countries that are more advanced than possessed by Israel. This way, the U.S. guarantees that Israel has a military superiority over Palestinians.
I want to just take a minute to discuss what's happening in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. We're deeply concerned about what we're seeing there. Images that came out overnight are harrowing, and the loss of any civilian life is a tragedy. I've asked Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Hadi Amer to go to the region immediately to meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He will bring to bear his decades of experience, and in particular, he will urge on my behalf and on behalf of President Biden a de-escalation of violence. We are very focused on this. The United States remains committed to a two-state solution.
Palestinians have defied the odds and keep portraying their defensive might to Israel's war machine. Apart from military aid, the U.S. also invests in Israel every now and then, like $1.6 billion in U.S. funding, in addition to the yearly allocation for improvement and deployment of the Iron Dome.
The right of self-defense for Israel, the one-sided claim, is or has been a well-planned, normalized line in American policy and on American U.S. mainstream media. And this is very unfortunate because it totally erases power dynamics in the context of Palestine. that Israel is actually considered the fifth most powerful country in terms of its arms and its actually surveillance in industries and its military industries, and that it is actually inflicting a total war on mainly unarmed, you know, Palestinian population, even in Gaza with Hamas rockets. I mean, the rockets that Hamas actually fires towards Israel are no comparison to the Israeli military and their use of the Iron Dome to intercept, of course, you know, rockets, and the ability for them to use F-35, you know, jets that are used only in the context of Gaza. So it's a ridiculous, you know, line that unfortunately in the U.S. we are normalized to accept.
One of the most vocal critics of Israel is Palestinian-American Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who has been an outlier as Michigan representative in the Democratic Party over her pro-Palestine position. Tlaib brought the issue to the White House with tears in her eye over the deadly aggression on Gaza.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight, I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom, so that when we die together, and no one would live to mourn the loss of another one." The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live without fear, and to grow old without painful trauma and violence.
But the apartheid crackdown is incrementally cracking, and the downward Israeli spiral could be clearly seen on the horizon with the resistance's preparedness and strong presence in Palestine. That comes despite U.S. full support for the Zionist regime, which today the government is struggling to justify.
The American public, and particularly progressives in the U.S. who opposed these assaults, saw what these weapons were doing. There was pressure on members of Congress to stop this arms sale. But prior to this assault, if this hadn't taken place, nothing would have been said or done about the arms sale. The U.S. public is very poorly informed about U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East and particularly as it relates to Palestine.
Israel must be held accountable for its war crimes, a stance also adopted by Muslim Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. One of the most flagrant violations by Israel is illegal construction of settlements for Israelis on Palestinian lands, something the regime has never stopped despite official pressure from other countries.
And their far-right ethno-nationalist leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, has legally razed Palestinian ancestral homes, leveled entire neighborhoods, and violently suppressed any resistance. This is all to make way for illegal Israeli settlement outposts designed to displace Palestinians from their homes and prevent a future Palestinian state.
Israeli settlements are built on the occupied Palestinian territories and are hence subject to the Geneva Conventions, which forbid construction on occupied lands. There are over 120 illegal settlements built since Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories in the West Bank in 1967. So does the Israeli version of the events make sense?
The Israeli story is not making any sense to many Americans anymore. I mean, people see the death in Gaza, the destruction. How can they justify the destruction of or damaging 7 hospitals, for example? How can they justify shelling and basically destroying the only COVID clinic in Gaza? How can they justify killing 22 members of one family with one missile hit? How can they actually explain the killing of 12 little girls getting psychological treatment at a facility?
There are efforts on the way to shift the U.S. attitude in endorsing Tel Aviv militarily. Jewish Senator Bernie Sanders is among the top critics of regime in Congress. Sanders has pointed to the self-evident suggesting that the U.S. treatment of the conflict is not even-handed.
Given the incredible suffering in Gaza, where we have a poverty rate of 56%, 70% of the young people are unemployed, and after the Israeli attacks, you have wastewater plants destroyed, clinics destroyed, hospitals destroyed. I think the United States has got to develop an even-handed approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We have to be pro-Israel, but we have to be pro-Palestinian, and I hope and believe the president understands that. And I was delighted to see that he is moving forward.
One could say that historically, the U.S. has not been pro-Israeli in its foreign policy, but rather anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian. From the left to the right, liberals or conservatives, Democrats or Republicans, American politicians have always made sure their pledge to Israel is heard loud and clear. But that appears to be changing.
Young people oppose Israeli violence and Israeli brutality in much higher numbers than ever before, especially progressive urban young people. The Arab immigrant population is becoming more outspoken and less afraid of being painted as terrorists, and so the youth are getting out in the streets. And people are just genuinely horrified by what they've been seeing on social media, including from English-speaking accounts of Palestinian residents of the Gaza Strip, showing what Israel's actually doing. It can be seen in a way that it hasn't before. And so people are voicing their outrage on a human rights basis.
Another outspoken figure speaking out against Israel is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. AOC has been leading an effort to block some military aid to Israel. Others joining her to block a sale of precision-guided weapons to Israel include Representative Rashida Tlaib, Mark Pocan, and Ilhan Omar.
And when I saw those airstrikes that are supported with U.S. funds, I could not help but wonder if our communities were practice for this. This is our business because we are playing a role in it. And the United States must acknowledge its role in the injustice and human rights violations of Palestinians.
Partisan jostling on Capitol Hill over U.S.-Israel relations has indeed escalated significantly. Whether or not a sale of Boeing-built armed guidance kit is blocked has a symbolic significance as the Biden administration tries to keep control of the situation and prevent U.S. politics from heating up.
The Israeli military and their use of the Iron Dome to intercept, of course, you know, rockets, and the ability for them to use F-35, you know, jets that are used only in the context of Gaza. So it's a ridiculous, you know, line that unfortunately in the U.S. we are normalized to accept. However, as I said before, you know, things are changing. People are recognizing that Israel is the colonial power and it is colonizing and controlling Palestinians and their lives under brutal military occupation and hegemony.
Stay tuned for more.
All the Biden administration's attempts have failed, both to allegedly pressure the Israeli prime minister or keep the pro-Palestinian shift in liberals on his own side. Israel continued its aggression regardless. From the get-go, the Biden administration indicated some indifference towards the conflict and just ignored Israel's atrocities.
Minister, Prime Minister Netanyahu informed me that Israel has agreed to a mutual unconditional ceasefire to begin in less than 2 hours. The Egyptians have now informed us that Hamas and the other groups in Gaza have also agreed. In my conversation with President Netanyahu, I commended him for the decision to bring the current hostilities to a close within less than 11 days. I also emphasize what I've said throughout this conflict. The United States fully supports Israel's right to defend itself against indiscriminate rocket attacks from Hamas and other Gaza-based terrorist groups that have taken the lives of innocent civilians in Israel.
President Biden has been treading a fine line in trying to appeal to his base without making Israelis angry. Simultaneously dealing with both the opposing demands appears to have been on top of the agenda for the Democratic administration so far. That was our show.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abideen, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatul Sajjadiyya. We have been discussing the seventh supplication of Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam, and that is his supplication during incidents of sorrow, painful occasions, and intense grief. We were in verse number 4, where Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam actually teaches us how to express the difficulties that we have, but in a monotheistic expression. And Imam says, "You alone are called upon for affairs of difficulty, and you alone are the refuge in painful occasions. None except that which you avert is averted, and none save that which you remove is removed." So the gist of this is actually the expression of Tawheed. But what is important here is that when we say that you alone are the refuge in sorrowful occasions or painful occasions, the most important thing, brothers and sisters in Islam, is that we should develop that belief. Even if we have developed a belief through conceptual knowledge, because conceptual knowledge also reaps belief. When you have proper reasoning according to the standards of reasoning, and you come to the conclusion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's being, that Allah exists, and that Allah is infinite in existence, and that Allah has power over all the creation, and that every moment it is He who is controlling the universe, and ontologically everything is submissive to Him. These are expressions that should not be mere vocalizations and expressions. They should have reached your heart, and you believe in it, and then you converse with Allah and you mean it. Oh Allah, you are the refuge in sorrowful occasions. You are the one to be called for ultimately. Even if somebody refers to other people, it is you who are actually giving the power and giving the support and so on.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah.